From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Biden visits a community college in Virginia today to sell his two big infrastructure plans. He's proposed free two-year community college for anyone who wants it. There is, of course, a lot more to those plans, but right now we want to take a closer look at one other issue in particular, and that's childcare. Biden is proposing $225 billion to subsidize the cost of childcare for low and middle income families. And joining us now is Shefali Luthra, reporter for the 19th. And Shefali, put this $225 billion into context. What impact would it have?
The impact would be tremendous. The largest impact perhaps would be on low income families, right, who would have free childcare through this plan. The Biden administration says that if you're middle class, it would, if you make up to 150% of the median income in your state, cap what you pay for childcare at no more than 7%. In a ton of states, more than 30, childcare costs more than in-state college tuition. We'd see investments in quality of childcare, right? Better learning modules, smaller class sizes, and we'd see a $15 minimum wage for childcare workers. All of these would be really transformative for both the industry and for access to childcare.
$225 billion is a lot of money, but Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Patty Murray are proposing more than twice that, right?
They are. Patty Murray has called for $600 billion. Elizabeth Warren, $700 billion. Patty Murray says her bill is what it would take to achieve a child care program that fully addresses low-income and middle-income family need. Elizabeth Warren's proposal is for universal child care. Even $225, while far less than those proposals, though, would be historic and transformative for this industry.
Okay, some money, $40 billion, was passed for childcare facilities as part of the COVID relief bill. And the president is proposing an additional $25 billion for additional facilities as part of his infrastructure proposals. Tell us exactly what that money would do.
So we saw over the past year, the childcare industry has just been so hard hit. And the numbers are still coming together. It's going to take a long time for us to really understand this, but childcare is a low profit margin industry. And with pandemic lockdowns and people staying at home, a lot of these centers lost a lot of money. When they had to reopen, they had to pay a lot more to have safe facilities in place and safe social distancing procedures. And that combined loss of income and increase in costs meant a lot shut down. So the $40 billion that passed in the rescue plan and the subsequent $25 billion in the jobs bill would together stop the bleeding, right, and bring us back to where we were before the pandemic when we still didn't have a ton of childcare, but we had an industry that existed. And that is something that has just really changed in the past year.
Let's go into politics for a moment. Just this Sunday on Fox News, host Chris Wallace challenged Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who's a Republican, over his opposition to government-funded child care service. Let's listen.
25%, one in four of the children in Louisiana are in poverty. And according to the White House, 42% of residents in Louisiana do not have access to child care. So don't they want, wouldn't they benefit, forget whether it's infrastructure or not, wouldn't they benefit from these government programs?
So I don't know if they would. If you think about the main driver of elevating out of poverty, it's good education.
Shefali, is this a sign that this child care money is going to be a major political fight?
It seems that for the past recovery bill, right, a lot of the efforts to put big money into things did meet Republican resistance. It's also clear, right, that even if there are political fights over whether this money is too much money, there are ways for big increases in spending to pass without the support of most Republicans.
You mentioned how hard hit this industry has been over the last year. Can you give us a sense of the toll?
It's been really, really hard for women and especially women of color. The childcare industry predominantly employs women, and a large percentage of those women are not white. And it's contributed to the economic devastation that we've seen that has really affected not everyone equally, and particularly hard-hit women.
Shefali Luthra is a reporter for The 19th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In India, there was vote counting over the weekend after elections held in the midst of a COVID crisis that may be the world's worst. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party lost some state and legislative races, but remained popular elsewhere, despite Modi having downplayed the severity of the pandemic. Will that hold as India's COVID death toll continues to mount? Barkha Dutt is a veteran journalist based in New Delhi, founder of the news site The Mojo. She's on Skype. And Barkha, we have to start with condolences. You just lost your father to COVID-19.
Yes, Robin. It's what I've been calling the news coming home. The last 15 months of my journalistic life have actually been spent on reporting the COVID-19 pandemic from across India. And it has been surreal and heartbreaking to become part of the story that I was reporting, something I would not wish upon any journalist. And yet, in this moment of personal devastation, I had my own struggles. We had a struggle to organize a private ambulance for him in which the cylinder faltered, the oxygen cylinder. We struggled to find cremation space for him. We had to call the police to cremate him. But I am aware of my privilege, of my access to resources, of the fact that I could even get him a bed and the best possible help, whereas my countrymen and women are not in that position. And I have personally lost count of the number of people who are dying at the doors of hospitals that are shutting their emergency wards to them because they do not have oxygen, ventilators, drugs, staff, or help.
Well, you're very generous in thinking about others, and there are so many others to think about. Talk about India's oxygen crisis, as you call it. People gasping for air in the street, trying to find oxygen cylinders, not enough ventilators. We've talked about no hospital beds at all. What is, if anything, is being done to address this crisis?
We keep being told every day that it's going to get better, and every day comes with a new horror of patients dying in hospitals. I've counted 3 hospitals in the past week in the national capital alone, where in 3 different incidents, 12, 25, and 25 people died, not from COVID. I just want to underline this. They did not die from COVID. They died because the basic treatment that they were supposed to be given, which is high flow oxygen, was not available to them. There is no other way to put it. And doctors have said it, this is not natural death, this is murder. When institutionally you fail to provide patients treatment that they have a right to access, that is murder. Even as we say all this, the center and the state governments are squabbling in court. Can you imagine we have an ongoing case in the courts of this country while our citizens are literally gasping for breath? That is where we are right now. That is how bad it is.
Well, but if this is murder, then who do the people think is the murderer? Prime Minister Modi has had huge election rallies without masks. Members of his party have ordered social media to take down critical posts about his handling of the crisis. There are reports they've even threatened to arrest people calling attention to the country's oxygen shortage. Do people blame him?
So I would say that there is an all-around disillusionment and anger and rage with our policymakers, in which the central government, led by the prime minister, certainly must take its share of accountability. There is also some anger with local governments, so it's a combined anger. But the fact is that it's the prime minister's face on that vaccine certificate. You know, when you get a jab in India, it's the prime minister's face on that vaccine certificate that you get. Mm-hmm. And the fact is there aren't enough vaccines to go around. People who were due to get their scheduled second dose haven't been able to, at a time when we need to be ramping up vaccines. Our vaccination rates have fallen. This is because the government completely misread the second wave. It did not purchase enough vaccines. It stood on nationalist pride and gave away and gifted and exported vaccines when we didn't have enough for our own people. And you're right, through all of this, mammoth rallies, religious congregations and political congregations continue to be held. And so I think there's a sense of pain turning to fury. And there's also that sense of a government that's lying to you. We had India's law officer tell the Supreme Court 2 days ago that there was no oxygen shortage. 1 day later, 12 people died in the ICU of a hospital in the capital. I think people are furious at being lied to.
One last question. What happens in a country during a pandemic doesn't stay in a country. Viruses don't stay within borders, which is why other countries are beginning to ban travel from India. The U.S. is going to ban travel from India starting tomorrow. Do you worry that your country will be increasingly isolated?
I do. And I also think it's not smart scientifically. I can understand the need to shut it down for countries as an immediate short-term response. But if you believe that India can be ravaged and the world can be safe, that is not going to happen. So if we don't touch your hearts and we don't touch your conscience for your own sake, we need vaccines. We need vaccines like yesterday. We don't have enough vaccines to go around. And, you know, shutting countries off from each other is not just separating families and friends and lovers. It's also drawing artificial lines across a world that can no longer afford it. What happens to us will happen to you eventually, and vice versa.
Bracha Datt, founder of Mojo, columnist for the Hindustan Times and the Washington Post. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me.
This week marks the beginning of the end. Last night was the first episode of the last season of the groundbreaking FX show, Pose.
The category is live, work, pose.
Over three seasons, this award-winning series has gained critical acclaim by taking us back to the 80s and 90s, the golden age of the underground ballroom subculture in New York City. The show holds the distinction of casting the largest number of transgender actors in TV history and sets the record of having the largest LGBTQ crew of all time. The creation of Pose was first developed by three people who had a mutual love and appreciation for Paris is Burning, the highly acclaimed documentary from 1990 by Jenny Livingston.
This movie is about the ball circuit.
A competition among gay people under one roof.
It's like crossing into the looking glass.
Ryan Murphy, the Emmy-winning TV producer, was one of those obsessed with Paris is Burning. So much so, he optioned the rights to it. But as he started to develop it, Murphy realized something.
I realized this is not my story to tell. This is my story to support, but I just don't feel like I could tell it authentically. So I put it on pause. And then as the heavens sort of opened for me, because I got a call from a woman named Sherry Marsh, who I knew, and she said, I have a really brilliant young writer who has a script that is about the ballroom community. And I was stunned.
That young writer was Stephen Canals, who wrote the screenplay for Pose when he was in film school at UCLA. Murphy says within 45 minutes of meeting each other, he was sold. But it actually took a little longer for Canals, who by that time had already received 150 rejections.
Every time my phone rang and I didn't know the number, I was convinced it was going to be my team telling me he changed his mind.
I recently caught up with co-creators Stephen Canals, Ryan Murphy, and writer and director Janet Mock. And Mock started off our conversation by talking about how the crew used Paris is Burning as a jumping-off point to go even deeper with the fictionalized characters in Pose.
Paris is Burning is, you know, one of the foundational texts of the queer and trans community, specifically for folk of color. And so I think that one of the things that hits me so hard with Paris is Burning is really the story of Venus Extravaganza and sometimes the lack of context to what made her life and her fire extinguish so clearly. And I think that one of the tenets on our show in our room has always been, yes, we're going to talk about the bad things that these characters go through, the struggles, the obstacles, but we're never going to forget the joy and the life, right? And the want for love, the want for dreams and joy, the visions that they were going after, that really colored our show and affected and changed us. And I think that similar to Paris is Burning, it is about society's rejects coming together and forming something so magical that is rooted in being your full authentic self.
Okay, I'm going to play this unfair game of asking all of you to name your favorite character, which I know is like asking you to name your favorite child. But I'd really like to know what character is going to stay with you well after this show is over. And I'll start with you, Janet.
Angel Evangelista. I think that's hands down. I think that I've had beautiful, challenging, evolving, full relationship with the actor India Moore, who plays Angel. We've had deep conversations about the importance of this character. She's always been the ingenue of the show. Every season she's had a storyline anchored in her quest to be loved and to love.
I want a home of my own.
Hey.
I want a family.
Hi. Oh, baby.
I want to take care of someone.
What is this? Here, let's lock it over.
And I want someone to take care of me.
And I think that that quest has always been inside of me. You know, growing up in a world where, you know, in middle school and high school, I just sat and watched my peers be able to hold hands with whoever they want. And me longing for that kind of connection and love. And I see so much of myself in Angel. And her arc this season is one that is deeply important and personal to me. And I know in conversations that I have had with trans women since I was 12 years old, that that universal search to be loved and embraced is deeply transformative.
Mm, Ryan.
That's a tough one for me, although the character that I'm the most like and relate to the most would be Elektra, for sure. But the character that I am always the most emotional about is Blanca. And I think a lot of it is about the actress we found to play that part, which is MJ Rodriguez, who I think particularly in season 3 of the show gives one of the great performances in the history of television. So I would say Elektra in the writer's room and Blanca on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, I think I asked you this question before and we had the same person, but who lives within you and who will continue to live with you after this show ends?
Well, I gave birth to twins. There are two characters for me. The first being Lil Poppy, played by Angel Bismarck Curiel, who from his inception, that character for me was always a representation of the boys who I knew when I was growing up on, you know, those hard scrabble streets in the South Bronx, who could care less what your identity was. They couldn't care if you were queer. They didn't care what people were saying about you. They just saw human. They just loved you for who you were. And they respected you and they protected you. Mm-hmm. And then the other character for me is Blanca. Blanca raised me, really and truly. Mm-hmm. You know, Blanca is my grandmother. She's my abuelita. She's my mom. She's my aunties. She's my titis. She's my sister. She's every Black and Brown woman who has been standing beside me and has said, you've got this. You're good. You're worthy. You're going to be okay. I love you.
I don't understand what you want me to do. We've accepted our fall class. We are full.
No, but he is special. He's got all the talent and all the hurt. You need to be a true artist. Let him dance for you. Give him a chance. Give him 3 minutes of your time. When was the last time you were truly surprised by something in your life?
Who are you again?
I'm his mother.
And so for me, Blanca, she honors all of those women, and I'll love her forever.
This series has been really powerful for so many people, myself included. We know transgender people have never been more visible, not just on shows like Pose, but also in positions of power. And at the same time, more and more states are seeking to pass anti-trans legislation. I'm just curious from you, how would you describe this moment we're in? Janet.
Yeah, I think that the visibility that we have is deeply affirming for folks who have historically and for so long needed it. But at the same time, I think it's also deeply fearful for folks who didn't know that we all existed. And I think that that fear can make people do irrational and crazy things. Irrational and crazy things like blocking trans children from having, you know, rights and access to the healthcare that they need. And I'm just really proud and glad that we do exist in a world where a show like Pose can be the antithesis to this kind of rhetoric that is deeply dangerous, that pushes trans youth out of their homes, queer youth out of their homes, put them onto the streets, and makes them that much more vulnerable.
Yes, Ryan.
My view about the show is simple. You know, I think art at its best can be activism. And I think this show is activism. I think I read some recent statistic that says only one in every 50 people say they've ever met a trans person. So I think when you watch this show, you've met one and you've fallen in love with one. And you think that Blanca and Angel and Electra are your friends. And I think it's so informative and educational for people to see the humanity behind everyone in our show. And in that way, I think it is activism. And it's really put something both entertaining, but also educational into the world.
Mm-hmm. Before I let the three of you go, Stephen, without giving away spoilers, you have to prepare us. How are we going to feel at the end of this season? Am I going to be crying? Am I going to be laughing, satisfied, yearning for more? What?
It's all of it. You'll be laughing, you'll be crying, you're going to be cheering, you're going to be gagged by the epic reads. Like, it's exciting because I think if you go back to our first season, from the very beginning, these characters were always very transparent about what their hopes and desires were for their futures. And so this third season, what was so exciting for all of us was to explore, what does it look like when a person finally gets to that place where all of the things that they've wanted most, they've accomplished that? They're no longer struggling. And what are the joys and also the complications of that happening?
Stephen Canals, Ryan Murphy, and Janet Mock on the final season of the FX original series Pose. Thank you to the three of you for this gift.
Thank you for all your support from the beginning.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories? Maybe encouraging them. Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
Homeless advocates in Austin, Texas are concerned about how police will implement a ban on public homeless encampments, which was reinstated by 57% of the voters over the weekend. Let's look at this and other election results in Texas with Alana Rocha, a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alana, start with this homeless camping ban in Austin. Critics say it means expensive citations that create a record and make it harder for people to get into housing. Supporters say they were worried about health risks. Austin is a pretty progressive pocket in this red state. So talk about how this debate is unfolding.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it, it doesn't seem somewhat that it's not completely partisan as far as the split here. If people are seeing these encampments in their backyards, essentially, or, you know, on their routes to work or wherever they're going, that influenced a lot of the vote. Although they said during early voting, the fact that the electorate seemed to skew older and Republican played into the fact that, you know, this was a 21,000 vote split in between those who voted to, you know, lift the ban or keep it in place or reinstate it, rather. And so, it's a hard issue. And the fact that there was no solution here. There's no solution at the state level. There's a couple bills moving through the legislature that would ban encampments statewide without putting any money into the issue of addressing the homeless here in Texas. And so advocates say this is just the stick method as far as pushing the homeless further into the shadows.
Yeah, there was also a congressional race on the ballot on Saturday for the 6th Congressional District. A lot of people watching this closely. It was to fill a seat of the late Ron Wright, who died of COVID-19 in January. It's going to be a runoff between his widow, Susan Wright, who had former President Trump's endorsement, and Jake Elzey, a top GOP fundraiser. Now, they shut out Democrats. It was a packed lineup, 23 candidates. One Democrat did come, you know, within a few hundred votes. But what does this race tell us about intra-Republican politics, state politics? What does it tell us?
Yeah, a lot of money here. A lot of course, Susan Wright, yes, is the widow of the late Ron Wright, but she's also herself a veteran GOP activist and no stranger to the party and politics. And so she had the largest share of institutional and elected official support going into this race. Elzy, as you mentioned, was a top fundraiser. He had the backing of former governor and former energy secretary Rick Perry. It'll be interesting. I mean, the district was once strongly Republican, but it has quickly trended blue in recent statewide election results, with former President Trump won it last year by only 3 percentage points, but Ron Wright won re-election by 9 points in 2020. Mm-hmm. So this will be interesting to see how it moves forward between the top two Republicans, and the fact that it's the real first gauge of Trump's influence since he's left office.
Yeah. Well, briefly, let's touch on another race you're watching closely. This is the Fort Worth mayor's race. Now, this county is where Beto O'Rourke and Joe Biden have had some success. So now there's going to be a runoff to replace the outgoing mayor, Betsy Price, between a Democrat and a Republican. What are you seeing there?
Well, the office is normally nonpartisan, but Betsy Price is a longtime Republican, one of the few remaining GOP mayors of a large American city, and the top two finishers that will go to a runoff that is yet to be announced as far as the date goes are Republican and Democrat. Maddie Parker is a former chief of staff for Price, and Deborah Peoples is a current chair of the local Democratic Party. So this is one to watch for sure, given the recent swing or trend there in that county.
Alana Rocha, reporter with the Texas Tribune. Alana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A judge will begin considering today whether Apple is justified in making app makers use the company's payment technology. The trial stems from a lawsuit filed by Epic Games, that's the maker of the popular game Fortnite, which Apple booted from its platform last summer for not complying with the rule. The trial is expected to last 3 weeks, and the ramifications could upend the $100 billion app market or even change the way we use smartphones. Ina Fried is chief technology correspondent for Axios, and she joins us now. Ina, welcome back.
Hi, Tanya.
Okay, so a U.S. district judge in Oakland is hearing arguments on whether Apple is essentially running a monopoly with its app store, and if Apple should be allowed to take a 30% cut in in-app purchases. How did this dispute really come about? What is the gaming company saying about Apple?
So it started, frankly, because Epic decided it just didn't want to play by the current rules and felt like they were unfair. So Epic basically updated Fortnite to introduce its own payment mechanism, really knowing full well and planning to start a legal dispute. They did the same thing on Android. Apple and Google both pretty much immediately booted them from their respective app stores, and then Epic filed suit. So there aren't really a dispute over the facts of what happened. There's really a dispute over whether Apple has an illegal monopoly and whether it's abusing that monopoly.
I see. And what is Apple's argument to this accusation of being a monopoly?
So Apple says it depends how you define the market. Sure, they have a monopoly over iOS, but really the market here is all the different types of things you can use to play games. And it competes in that sense with customers who are playing on their Xbox or PlayStation or on a PC or on Android. So what it's saying is it's not the market at issue isn't whether we have a monopoly over iOS. Clearly we do, but we're entitled to that. Our, you know, controlling our own ecosystem is okay. And look at the Xbox, look at PlayStation.
Okay. Of course, this trial is just beginning. But do you have any indication based on the judge or previous cases on how things are expected to go?
Yeah, there's a few things that give us some insight. First of all, before the trial happened, right when the suit was filed, Fortnite asked to be kept on the App Store, or Epic asked for Fortnite to be kept on the App Store and to be able to continue to have access to developer tools. And the judge in the case basically kept the status quo. So she didn't put Fortnite back on the App Store, but she also said Apple had to keep giving developer support to Epic. So in that sense, she's kind of ridden down the middle of the line. Most of the experts think that Epic faces an uphill battle, but that Apple has more to lose. So Epic has the tougher case here. It's got to show that Apple's monopoly is a monopoly and that it was unjustly tied and that the facts support opening it up. And it's asking for a huge relief. It's asking for the business terms of the App Store to change. It's not asking for money damages. It's saying we want Apple to change its whole way of doing business. So that's an uphill legal battle, but obviously the stakes for Apple are huge. Apple has more to lose here.
Absolutely. I mean, what could this actually mean for iPhone users and really for people who don't use an iPhone, but also maybe use an Android?
So probably not a whole lot for those who use Android. For those who use the iPhone, you know, if Epic were to prevail, other app providers could either use Apple's payment system for in-app payments, or they could use their own. That might lead to somewhat lower prices. That's certainly what Epic is saying. Apple is saying it could be a security issue, a claim that Epic contests. So, you know, it could mean a much more open Apple iPhone with all the good and bad that comes with that.
Ina Fried is Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. We will link you to more of her reporting on hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tanya. Always good.
Yes, always good to talk with you. Well, millions of feet of lead pipes deliver water in the U.S., posing a risk most often for Black and Hispanic and low-income communities. As part of his infrastructure plan, President Biden wants to spend $45 billion to replace every lead pipe in America. Well, Newark, New Jersey is already on its way to replacing lead pipes in that city. In 2018, Newark was being compared to Flint, Michigan, after elevated lead levels in the water forced residents to switch to drinking bottled water. The advocacy group, the Newark Education Workers Caucus, and the Natural Resources Defense Council sued the city. And today, Newark is well on its way to removing more than 18,000 lead service lines. Yvette Jordan is a high school history teacher in Newark Public Schools and chair of New Caucus, as it's called, and she joins us now. Yvette, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. How did all of this begin for you? When did you realize this was a problem?
Well, actually, in February of 2018, I was sitting in a meeting with New Caucus, and somebody attended our meeting from NRDC and said to us really bluntly, "Are you aware there is lead in your water?" And we said, "What?" So we were flabbergasted about that. And they said, "Yes, we informed your mayor. He is ignoring it, and unfortunately, we feel that a federal suit should be filed." So that's what happened in February of 18.
In 2018, according to the city's water quality report, lead levels at several sites were above 47 parts per billion. No amount of lead is safe, but this was several times higher than what the EPA allows. At the time, the mayor was insisting that Newark was not Flint. What did that insisting that it was not a problem say to you?
Well, that was upsetting. And since my home was one of those houses over three times the federal action level, I was extremely upset. So I feel that knee-jerk responses and denials is really bothersome, and it has no place in what we are trying to do, which actually is inform everybody there is no safe level of lead.
What do you think it was that pushed the change?
There were a confluence of events. So there were these lead exceedances. At the same time, our mayor was running for office in May. So at the same time, Amazon is looking for a regional hub. At the same time, Newark is being gentrified. And at the same time, the Video Music Awards are coming here. So our mayor is, I'm sure, saying, "Well, I don't want anybody thinking we have lead in our water. We've got to do something." So millions of dollars were infused by the county as well as the state for lead service line removal. However, unless the community was not advocating for change, I don't feel any of it would happen.
Well, to your point here, many municipalities are taking a page from your city. Typically, the cost of replacing a lead service line ranges anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000. This costs nothing to residents, not directly, but the city had to borrow $120 million to make this happen, as you kind of laid out.
Right.
So this is not cheap. If President Biden's infrastructure plan is not passed, what would convince cities to spend that kind of money based on this experience that you just had with your city?
Well, first of all, lead is a potent neurotoxin, and it impacts our children and our infants. So if we're thinking of the succeeding generations, right, this is foundational, right? Water is life, and we must understand that.
How do you talk about this with your students? I mentioned that you're a high school history teacher.
When all of this was happening, actually, I was teaching intro to social justice, and I use this as a case study as well as other areas in our country. But my students who have experienced some of this in terms of you've got to filter your water and flush were angry, anxious. So educating them and letting them know use of your voice is really power. And that's what I try to convince residents about and my students about.
Before I let you go, Yvette, Newark is now being hailed today as a model for other cities. What do you say to other cities out there?
I say, don't allow local officials to deny what is needed in your community and have these knee-jerk minimization of the problem responses, because you have to understand no level of lead is safe.
Yvette Jordan is a high school history teacher in Newark Public Schools and chair of New Caucus, which sued the city of Newark to replace more than 18,000 lead service pipes. Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you.
About half of U.S. adults have gotten at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, but the vaccination rate is slowing. It's down 20% in the past 2 weeks. And health experts now think we may never reach herd immunity, in which at least 80% of the U.S. is inoculated. The only sure way to reduce the virulence of the virus and decrease outbreaks, hospitalizations, and deaths to near zero. There are still millions of people who say they will not get vaccinated. And Derek Thompson wanted to know why. So he tweeted out and asked to talk to people. They responded. Derek, of course, staff writer for The Atlantic. He joins us every Monday. Derek, these are not anti-vaxxers. These are anti-COVID vaccines. Sum up their reasoning for us. What'd you hear?
I think it's a great introduction. You know, I really did just want to understand this position and write something that was more of an ethnography of a position I didn't understand rather than a takedown. And this is, I think, the best way to summarize their position. The people who describe themselves not, as you said, as anti-vaccines in general, but as against the COVID vaccine. They trust their own cells more than they trust Big Pharma, and they trust their own ability to research and root out the truth about this pandemic and the vaccines than they trust the public health community or democratic elites. So this is a group that I think has taken it upon themselves to learn about the pandemic and learn about what these vaccines do. And as a result, I think have reached conclusions that even though they include a lot of facts, are often very oriented around the idea that if they're about 35 or 25, then they're safe. They don't think as much about the broader community. And so much of our conversation was about getting them to expand their circle of care from the individual to the group.
And I want to get to that, but you know, this is so incomprehensible to some people, but it sounds like you came to this better understanding. And if I got this right, you say you canceled a wedding, a vacation, you stayed inside, you were rooting for the vaccines. These people mostly traveled, ate in restaurants, flouted rules of people, as you said, they think are liberals and they don't trust. And so they weren't rooting for the vaccines.
That's exactly right. You know, I want to be really fair to this argument, even though I disagree with it. Both groups, both my group, the pro-vaccine group, and the no-vaccine group, I think have a little bit of motivated reasoning going on. I sacrificed so much in the last 15 months, including, as you said, canceling my wedding. I, of course, was rooting for these vaccines to work. How could I not root for the vaccines to work? And therefore, was overjoyed when I thought objectively that these vaccines work. And I think in the real world, we are learning that they are working fantastically in the U.S., in Israel, and the United Kingdom. But for the other position, for the Novavax position, there is also motivated reasoning there. They have thought the coronavirus has been a wildly overrated threat from the beginning. They are telling themselves that, look, this might be a risk, but it's a risk no more than driving a car, something I do every day and would never change my life around. And so they see the cost-benefit analysis of these vaccines very differently from me. They don't see any costs to the pandemic because they have tried to live their normal life in the pandemic. The FDA has authorized these vaccines for an emergency. Well, they don't consider this a personal emergency. And so for both the yes vaxxers and the no vaxxers, I do think it is fair to say that our feelings about the vaccines are intertwined with how we think about the pandemic.
Right.
If the pandemic's a big deal, you want to get the vaccine. If you think the pandemic is no big deal whatsoever and it was overrated by, you know, liberal elites, then you are much more likely to see the downsides, the risks in the vaccines.
Okay, I want to get to some of your thinking about how these people might be reached. And there were some that were easier for you. In some cases, people who had a COVID-19 were misinformed. They thought, hey, I'm fully protected. You explain, well, actually, no, shots are far more protective. But some people aren't going to be dissuaded from their thinking. And so you said, do things like make it easier to get a vaccine, create a DoorDash for the vaccine. The shot will come right to their home. Or make it harder to not get a shot. Use proof of vaccination to get into stadiums or other large gatherings. But you caution that might backfire and become completely partisan.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about DoorDash for vaccines. This is an idea that actually came to me from a source who asked to remain anonymous, but has so far resisted getting a shot himself. His perspective is he doesn't really care about this pandemic, and so he doesn't really care about the vaccines. He said, if you want me to get a shot, you need to make it as easy as possible. And something like DoorDash for vaccines, where you make a reservation online, some state public health administrators come to your apartment, come to your house, give you the shot right there. You don't have to take a single second out of your day practically, and the shot will essentially come to you as if it's, you know, Chinese food being DoorDashed to your doorstep. This is a way, Derek, I think, to lower the barrier.
I just have to jump in to say there was that. There's also the notion of requiring vaccinations, but you say, okay, so red states will have people in stadiums and blue states won't. It'll become partisan. But just the last thought in the 30 seconds we have, somehow get them to see that they may be safe, but their grandparent isn't.
That's right. You know, the shots are best at protecting us from transmitting the virus to people who might be vulnerable. So what I kept telling people that I spoke to is your cells might be good enough to protect you, but the shots are better to protect grandpa.
Yeah. Derek Thompson, we'll link you to his writing at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thoughtful as usual. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.